Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning and leadership from the top minds in volleyball and beyond, with your hosts, John Mayer and Billy Allen.
We're excited to welcome to the show Pittsburgh Pirates assistant coach Jake Minkasi. Jake, thanks for joining us. I think I said the name right.
You did. Nailed it.
All right, cool. All right. I had a note and I got it. Got one right. Well, we appreciate you joining us. And Andy Bass, who our listeners will know, who's been awesome person on our show, and he's connected me with a lot of people. He recommended connecting with you. And I know you guys have worked together on the Pirates for years. But can you first just tell us a little bit more about your role with the Pirates?
Yeah, so I am not necessarily a coach. I am more so a support staff member. So my title is advanced scouting coordinator for the major league staff. So a lot of what I try and do is I'm always looking ahead. So when we're playing, we're just recently playing like the Brewers and the Toronto Blue Jays. During those games, I'm always watching the next series, the next games. And my main focus is opposing team pitching and opposing team defense, and then just a variety of other like little tasks, is try to be as helpful as I can in as many areas as I can. But basically just trying to prep my coaches and players to compete that night and win ultimately.
So if the team is in Chicago and they're playing next in Boston, like you'll be in Boston until they get there, or you watch it, or is it all film? You're not doing it live.
Yeah. So used to, there were in-person advanced scouts is what they're called. I don't know if there are any teams still doing in-person just because of the availability of video and technology, like you name it. We have a number for it or an acronym for it. So I'm with the team. I'm with the Major League Traveling Party. And part of the thought there is, I mean, we might get into the history of how I got to the big leagues, but I also caught in college, and just being able to fill a variety of roles is important for the Pirates organization. So try to do as much as I can on the field, help our third base coach, help our first base coach with day-to-day practice, and then also be able to look ahead.
That seems way better than, I guess, the old days where you're just by yourself at like random ballparks and alone, that you get to be with the team. You're still preparing them for the next series and you're making an impact on that series. So it seems like you have the best of both worlds there.
No question. And the ability to grab a glove and go out on the field and get away from the computer for a minute or two is one of the things I treasure the most.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, one of the topics is on multi-sport learning. I know you grew up playing baseball, but you also grew up playing hockey. Yeah. So how was it helpful? How did it serve you to play multiple sports?
Yeah, I know it's starting to get talked about more, but I think it should be talked about even more. It's so important for a variety of reasons. For me personally, it just kept things fresh. Like I always grew up playing hockey more than baseball, and it just so happened where it worked out where I'm working in baseball. But the summer was just to get away from the ice a little bit and, you know, go to some random Southern Illinois tournaments and play some baseball with my buddies. So that was important part of it. The other piece was like hockey players, hockey parents, they're just a different breed of people. They're just the absolute best, but it's a unique personality. So that has served me well, trying to navigate a major league clubhouse and a major league traveling party where there's a lot of unique, interesting personalities that you have to deal with and work with. And I think the other thing too, is I've worked in the industry I am in, like the skill transfer wasn't really anything remotely close, which I also think helped me quite a bit. Like nothing on the ice translated to the dirt and vice versa. So those are some of the things I think about the most, but I can't stress enough the need for young athletes, male and female, to play as many sports as possible.
I was thinking maybe you were a catcher, being a goalie, would there be some transfer there? You know, there are some like those like donor sports where you're like, oh, tennis and badminton maybe, but those two, there's not much transfer, huh?
I'm not that crazy. My mom, I don't think would have let me play catcher and goalie, but I will say, so I was a shot blocking defenseman. I had rock hard hands, so I wasn't able to stick handle the puck very well. So I was a shot blocking, penalty killing D man. And there was more than one occasion where a defenseman from the other team ripped a slap shot from the blue line, and just my catching habits, like I just tried to grab it, catch it, and put it down, and didn't feel great, but stopped the puck from going in the net. So
probably better to have a glove there, huh? Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do you see the lack of transfer as a good thing?
I just think it trains different parts of your mind and your body. For me, it was just, it was challenging and refreshing all in the same time. So that's, that for me is kind of how I think about it.
Is there anything you currently do to still be learning from sports outside of baseball?
Quite a bit. I try to, so we'll stick with playing for a second. Like, I still play hockey, and that is one of the things that I value most. It's where I'm happiest is on the ice and playing. And no matter how late we get back from a road trip, it's a 6:30 a.m. puck drop. So I am always there. And one of the benefits I've seen that wasn't necessarily something I was planning on, but in the gym, like, I want to get better, faster, stronger on the ice. And so that's kind of helped me stay locked in the gym.
You mentioned that maybe the skills don't translate sport to sport, but are there any principles or stories you want to share from like the cultures or just being around the different sports that have helped you like in your current role? Anything you learn from the hockey world that you use in baseball?
I think the selflessness of hockey players for me is something that comes to mind. It is such a team sport that, like, no matter if you have a bad game or a bad shift, like, you have four other guys that are pulling in the same direction as you are. And in baseball, like, oftentimes you're kind of on an island, like, especially if you're a pitcher, like, you're in control. And if you mess up, like, everybody knows. But on the ice, one thing I found value in is, like, having your other teammates, like, around you and having the ability to support you.
How do you, like, what, I want to hear more about this puck drop too. How is this with, like, you're traveling all around the country. Do you have, you just have like hockey groups that you find, or how do you stay consistent with it?
Yeah. So here in Pittsburgh, we have what's called the AMHL, and sponsored by Dunkin' Donuts actually. And it's just a group of professionals. Like, we have, it's a pretty impressive group. Like, we have some Pirates employees, we have some Penguins employees, we have some Meta Facebook employees, we have like ATF agents, you name it. At 6:30 a.m., it's a group of like 10 to 12 teams that compete for the coffee cup. And it's like, it's a great balance of people that want to get a sweat on before work and also not get like checked into the boards from behind and like have some like dirty play. Like, it's just a good pace of play, good camaraderie. But yeah, it's up at the UPMC Lemieux Center up in Cranberry. And it's like one of my favorite things ever. So, but cool. It's early morning puck drop. So
yeah. That's so cool to have that. Yeah, very, very awesome to have the community aspect, like you said, reasons to exercise, and then just to get to compete. Well, that's really cool.
John has a similar one. He finds a bouldering place anywhere, everywhere he goes.
Yeah, that's been my new. And that's great too. You can find them everywhere. It keeps me wanting to exercise. Like, oh, I got to be able to get that V7.
Yeah, it's so, like, for me, like, I went to school at St. Mary's University in Minnesota, not the one in California. And one of the things I was talking about this last offseason with the team is, like, the need for athletes or retired athletes to still continue to compete, because it's such a part of our being for 20 plus years. And oftentimes when it's ripped away from you, it's not by choice. So coaching, very helpful, and you're in the compete like arena, but you're not actually doing the competing or the competition. So something I found a lot of value in is getting back on the ice and actually doing it myself and still feeling that sense of team and still feeling that sense of like there's a win or a loss. And as a coach, you're certainly a part of the win and the loss and the black and the white. But for me, that's something that's been very helpful after playing competitively.
Yeah. And I imagine, I think all the benefits of remembering what it's like to struggle, to be frustrated, to learn a new skill, even maybe a coaching concept you've learned about, like, oh, I want to go try that in my, like, to have a space to still explore and not just have a academic sense, but to have an experiential reminder of it's, I think, really huge.
So funny you say that. I asked before we started recording if I could ask you guys questions. And that's one of the questions I had for Billy is, seems as though like he's in a unique opportunity where he's still competing at the highest level, but also coaching, and also as player development coordinator or director, like you're implementing all these things. Like for you, Billy, what's like something recent where like you've tried it in game, like for your own self, that you've translated to USC? Does that question make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
Stanford.
I feel like definitely more in practice than in game. I feel like once I'm competing, I mean, I guess there's mental stuff that I still, you know, if I'm telling my players to take time and to breathe and I'm not doing it, you feel like a fraud. But I would say in practice, we preach a lot of like, you know, get outside your comfort zone. We don't want these like feel good reps. We want to be like, you know, challenged and stretched. And even as a player, I gravitate towards like, yeah, I want to get some like some rhythm and some feel good reps as well. And so I just really like to, especially not being able to play and train quite as much as my competition, because I'm, you know, I have a full time job. I just really want to maximize my challenge opportunities. So every time I'm out there practicing, like, how can I make it as hard and uncomfortable as possible? Yeah, and kind of walk the walk. And like John said, it does like make you reflect on, yeah, if this is what my players are going through, it's very uncomfortable, and a little more empathy for them when we ask for some demanding, you know, drills and activities.
I have to just go one more hockey question to more just curiosity. My wife is a huge hockey fan, huge Kings fan. And if we did have a boy, which we didn't have, he would have been named Luke after Luke Robitaille.
L-U-C? Would you spell it?
Would have been L-U-C. Yeah, that was the but you're in Pittsburgh, but you're from Chicago. So who's your team?
Blackhawks.
Oh man, the Penguins are going to be pissed. Huh?
In the off seasons, I rarely miss a game.
Yeah.
We moved to Chicago in 2004, and at the time the Blackhawks were really, really bad. Mm-hmm. And my dad and I got lower bowl tickets for just absolutely nothing, pennies on the dollar, and wasn't able to go to many games when they were really good because it was just like out of reach. And so through thick and thin, Blackhawks all the way.
That's awesome. That's you know, the roots, where you're born, where you're from, you gotta, yeah, I get it. One more on the multi-sports, you know, you interact with all the major league ball players. Do they watch, do they study, or are they learning from other sports?
I would say a little bit less than like, say, for example, hockey. Like hockey, for example, like pregame, they're always playing soccer, like working on their hand-eye coordination. With baseball, most of it is sports specific. And outside of that, because it's such a long season, like we're going early February in spring training, and that's a month and a half of daily work. And then you go 162 games traveling all across the country until hopefully the end of October. So most of what is done is just trying to stay on the field because the best ability is availability. So most of it's sports specific. I would say probably a little bit less than other sports, just from my perspective, by nature of the monstrosity of the season.
With those demands, do you think there's still room to sprinkle in stuff? And if you could, what would you mix in that would be safe, or is it just, it's impossible?
So I guess we could. So with pitchers, like if they're not throwing, one thing that our strength coaches do is like they let them run routes in the outfield. So like the strength coach will throw the football and they'll run like a post route. I'm not honestly entirely sure like what I would do. I haven't thought about it at length just because of how long the days are and how difficult it is just to stay on the field.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's just a better, the answer is change the season. It's too long, too good. But too much history there, huh?
So before we move on, I'd like to go back to the principles that Billy
had.
Don't really like the answer that I gave, and I like the notes that I sent you. I want to make sure I hit on this because I think we'll hit on it later. So I went to New Zealand this last offseason, and it's still on my mind quite a bit. I don't know if either of you have been, but it's just the most beautiful place in the world. But some of the principles that I've tried to take with me doesn't matter the sport, the industry, whatever, is something from Legacy by James Kerr, and it's sweep the sheds and no dickheads. And sweep the sheds for me is essentially no job is too small. And I'm not saying like the CEO needs to be, you know, sweeping the sheds literally, but for people at my level, like that first coordinator level, that like assistant director level, that like think they're like all high and mighty because they got that first promotion, right? Like don't ever forget where you just were and how difficult oftentimes the boots on the ground work is. And we've all been around good leaders. We've all been around bad leaders, teammates, coaches, whatever. And for me, the best coaches I've ever been around are the people who are willing to do anything in order to help the team. Like, it's just fairly simple. And no dickheads is also very simple in my mind, is be a good dude, be a good woman, like be a good teammate, be somebody that you'd want to be teammates with or friends with. That's it. It's fairly straightforward.
It is really impactful. It's one thing to say it, but I think to really see it, like my athletic director, we were building beach volleyball courts and we're looking for a place on campus. And he was coming out like in his suit, and he would have our measuring tape like on hands and knees, trying to figure out like, is this enough space to do it? And you go, oh, like this is like the highest profile person in our department, and he's doing the dirty work. Okay, like I got to step up. Like I want to make sure I'm doing whatever it takes. So I think that, I mean, the way James Kern legacy explains it, and the way that team, the way they do the little things at such a high level, is impactful. But when you see it, it really does, I think, change the culture, and it changes your own behaviors. So it's a good message.
No question. I think one of my favorite quotes of all time is, the accumulation of little things is no little thing. And like your athletic director doing that, like that is a little thing that ultimately aids the health of the environment, the organization, that is the most important thing.
Yeah. And it helps make John a better leader by that example, which is cool.
Exactly. Yeah.
One of the other topics you brought to our attention was the idea of self-care. Yeah. And like something I think of that's important, but I can see in such a long baseball season getting overlooked. What do you recommend coaches do to take care of themselves?
I will provide a few examples. For me, one thing that has helped is, before I open my work laptop, before I think about anything work related, I try to buy myself some time in the morning. Like I don't check my phone. I don't do anything. It varies. It's not like the set morning routine, but I try to make my coffee. Like I have a Chemex, and like I grind beans, and when we come back off a road trip, I walk over to Allegheny Tea and Coffee Exchange and I try a new bag of beans. And I go through that, or I try and take 10 minutes to read something or listen to something. Like right now I'm on, there's an economist, that's The Economist. It's their podcast. It's like their 10-minute like daily brief, essentially. So I listen to that, watch a YouTube video. Like I just try to find a moment before I start to help others to help myself. And I found that to be very helpful. And the other thing that I wrote down here is, I'm not sure where this notion of no sleep became cool. Mm-hmm. Somewhere along the way, it's just like, yeah, I slept 2 hours last night, like pulled an all-nighter and, you know, grinded through this project or this, that, or the other thing. Like sleep is a superpower. Like you want to talk about the most important drug you can ever take? Like it's sleep. The benefits you get from that, like you can't mimic in day-to-day life. Like you can take as many cold tubs, you know, UV therapy sessions you want. Sleep is very important. And that's the other thing I've tried to prioritize. So those are two things that come to mind that are like very practical that I think anyone can implement. Now, I don't have children. I don't know what that's like. I know it's not that easy, but trying to find as much time for uninterrupted sleep is critical.
What about the challenges that a lot of athletes face? I mean, you guys especially face it, changing time zones, traveling after the game, the game's late, I want to go on social media, and by the time I fall asleep, like how do you, I guess, what habits do you create, and how do you make sure you are able to wind down and actually get the sleep that is so important, like you said?
Yeah, I'm fortunate because I can fall asleep anywhere at any time.
It's a big skill.
I got that from my father, which is awesome. But when you talk to players, like, and they're the ones competing, like I have no idea what it feels like to have the lights brightest with 50,000 people staring down at you. I have no idea what that feels like. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea what it feels like to try and wind down from that 162 times a year. For me, from my perspective, like have to stay off the phone, knee it back. You have to find something that helps you decompress, whether that's a walk, whether that's a hot shower, like you name it. But I can't imagine how difficult it is for players to get up and then down and then up and then down and then up and then down, all for sport.
Yeah, it is a lot. I think it's good to empathize with the challenges of it. And to, I think the more you, I guess, explain how important it is, then hopefully people can set up routines, even when there are no routines with all the differences they have. I wanted to go to, and this is maybe a trickier question, the idea of being a servant leader, I think, has become more in vogue, and there's a lot of good things to it, right? You're kind of like the example of sweeping the sheds. I'm doing all the things I can to serve the people I get to work with and work for. But it seems like there's maybe a space there where it goes too far, where, oh, I've got to watch this much video, or I've got to answer that recruit email, or I've got to, just, you know, do every little thing possible to serve the people I work with. So I guess, you know, how do you prioritize, any thoughts on, you know, that balance of being a healthy servant leader?
I will give credit to my fiance on this. And it's, if you can't take care of yourself, how do you expect to take care of other people? And that came from earlier this year, where we made a change on the coaching staff and some other support staff roles. And I wasn't in the gym as often as I usually am. And Nikki is her name. Like, she met me on the road, and I was like kind of nervous to ask her if I could go to the gym and just take the hour to kind of like mentally prepare for the day. And she basically just kind of called me out, which is one of the many reasons why I love her. Like, she's like, if you can't take care of yourself, like, how do you expect to take care of me and eventually like children and the people you work with? And like, those things compound over time. And then next thing you know, like, if you're not doing that for yourself, you look up in 5 to 10 years and you have unhealthy habits. And the servant leadership mentality, which is designed to be impactful and positive, turns into like the sharpest double-edged sword you could ever possibly find.
Do you have any tips or things that have worked for you as far as forming the habits and making them consistent? Because it seems like, you know, you can get fired up to go to the gym once or twice, get up early once or twice. Well, what's worked for you?
I think maybe this is like a kind of a roundabout way of thinking about it, but I think the most important thing that you or anyone can do is surround yourself with really good people and people that instill positive habits, because then you don't always have to be like relying on that self-discipline. Like, that, even like, I know motivation comes and goes, but the discipline also comes and goes over time. So Nikki, for example, like, is a great resource for me. And there's a group of us on the coaching staff that, you know, we are in the gym in the mornings, on the road. Like, we go to a separate gym to, pun intended, like, buy some time away from the park and make sure we take care of ourselves. Because if we're not taking care of ourselves, we can't take care of the players, or I can't take care of the staff members. And same could be said for teammates. Like, who you surround yourself with on the team is arguably the most important thing you do. That Sunday morning where, you know, we're technically off, like, are you going to go into the gym and like do a mobility session? Like, are you going to read the team book for the year on your own, or are you going to rely on your teammate to get it done? And for me, like, that's something that was always very important to me. And I've been very lucky to be surrounded by really, really good people by choice, but you had to learn a few hard lessons before you find those people. So I would say that is, from my perspective, like, the most important thing you can do.
I like that, the healthy version of peer pressure, where you have people modeling it, people pushing you, and even just telling them, like, call me out when I'm not. So I think that's probably the healthiest version. I want to hear more. You guys have a team book that you read for the year?
We do not. So back in college, we did.
Oh, okay. All right, got it.
The Pirates, no.
Okay. I was like, oh, that's amazing.
No.
Okay. Well, wanted to move to the next topic we had on the idea of reviewing and reflecting. Because, you know, I think pretty commonly, I think part of your role is, right, I'm preparing, we're going to execute, this is what's next. And we're thinking of either the present or the future. But I guess, why do you think reviewing and reflecting is so valuable?
I think the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. And if we're not constantly trying to get better, improve process, improve the results, and like try and beat the competitor. What are we doing? You know, so if you don't take the time to take a step back and analyze, then where are you going? Where are you going? Why are you going there? And you're probably getting there slower than you probably can be getting there. And over the course of a major league season, like you can kind of find yourself in a trance, you know, through spring training, through the long summers, like you just try and check the boxes and get the work done. And that's where it's important. Like going back to our last question, like having people around you, but also like your bosses and your peers that even might not necessarily be in your department, but are around the work enough. You have to be able to trust them and have built the relationship through time so they can inform you of when something's not good enough.
What suggestions do you have for making post-practice, post-training reviews effective?
Yeah, I think simple, clear after-action reports are some of the most valuable things you can provide your players and even staff members. For me, I'll use an example. Like for our team, like we value swing decisions. So are you swinging at strikes? Are you taking balls? And it's really important for us to have consistent, clear messaging and clear objective data supporting that, something that we value. And we can deliver those electronically through the app that we use, through text message, and also hard copies like on their chairs. And it needs to be consistent. Like if we're doing it one time a week and not after every single game, the message doesn't carry as much weight as it should. So that sometimes I think gets lost over the course of a season. Doesn't matter whether it's hockey, basketball, football, baseball. Like if you're not staying on consistent message as a staff too, like if you're sharing a consistent message, different tones, different voices, like different perspectives, but if it's not the same thing, the same clear goals and process-based messaging, you're going to lose buy-in. And the other thing that I wanted to share on that is formal is great and necessary, but in my opinion, informal feedback is arguably more important and better. Like we know the art of coaching. And for me, from my end, like being a support staff member, like we know in order to get to the player, we have to know how they learn. But on top of that, it's like the tone and the timing of that delivery is also important. So those are things that we think about, but after action reports, doesn't matter, the medium that you send them in are important, and it's critical that the timing, the tone, and the consistency of the message is there as well.
Yeah, I want to hear more about that communication. You mentioned a couple different mediums. You text the team some stuff. Like, can you go through some of the different ways you communicate?
Yeah, so we have a few different apps and many would probably say too many. So we have a thing called Teamworks. Essentially, that's where our schedule is sent out and like anything like team operations related. And then we have more of like the baseball strategy app, which is called PitchBase. That's where we send like the videos, the scouting reports, the swing decision reports, the after action reviews. We send all those things there. But then there's also some things that we double, triple down on that, okay, you have them here, you have them electronically. They're also going to be on your chair. And it's going to be the first thing that you see when you come in the next day.
How did you guys come to swing decisions as the principle? I sometimes think of maybe traditionally post review would be more on the mechanics or the proper movement, where this is more of just a general principle, right? Like decision making. So how did that come? I don't know if you even are aware, just organizationally.
Yeah. So it's one of many, many things that we value. We try to be an all encompassing, like offense, just speaking offensively, like we try to think about all things and value all things the way they should be based off of like some of what we value. We have to win a certain way in Pittsburgh. And in order to do that, we have to win games differently. And when you look across the league at teams that have had success, like they value players that control what they can control. And in many ways, like we can't sign players that hit 50 plus home runs a year. We're going to have to draft, develop them, and then ride them as long as we can. But we're going to have to death by a thousand cuts win a night. So that's an example of like why we value swing decisions more so than maybe another team. All teams want to be disciplined in the batter's box. but other teams have a little bit more margin for error than we might have. We have to value every single at bat highly throughout the game, because we're going to have to tack together 1 and 2 runs and not like 4, 5, and 6 from the home run or the long ball.
Great knowing who you are and not complaining about it, but figuring out how to maximize who you are and make the best of it. I mean, I guess it wasn't between Ohtani wasn't between the Dodgers and you guys. It was
he was not.
What that is a big mistake by
Juan Soto. Did not take a trip to Pittsburgh this last offseason.
Come on. Is there a difference between post game review and post practice review? And if there are, what are some of the differences in how you guys do it? And I guess you don't have too many practices.
Yeah. So our practices, it's weird. Our practices happen like day of game and before.
Yeah.
Game. I wouldn't say there's necessarily a difference. Maybe like the formal structure of here's a report versus the, like in the batting cages, for example, we have a lot of cameras. We have a lot of TV screens, which is both good and bad. So there's some instant feedback that our players get when they're in the cage. It's just like a 10-second delayed swing. So hitter swings, and then they have a second to catch their breath. They look at the TV, and they get instant feedback from a mechanical perspective. Mm-hmm. So that's just an example of like one thing we try to do like in real time. And then a lot of like the teaching, coaching throughout the day is just so informal, just because like there's 3-ish, depending on the team and organization, hitting coaches for the major league team. And there's 13 position players plus maybe a rehab guy or two. So you have to be aware of what each guy is working on. And that's why it's so important for all coaches to be on the same page, because you don't want a player, whether he's rehabbing from injury or an active player, like struggling and trying to figure it out. You don't want different messaging hitting the player all on the same day. That's like worst case scenario.
What are some negative traps you can warn coaches about when it comes to reviewing? Anything you've seen, you know, go wrong?
Yeah, I think most importantly, anyone involved in the coaching process. So that's a support staff member, an analyst, a coach, a front office member, talking too much. That is like disaster class. I would say only positive or only negative. I know there's a billion studies out there. Like, is it good to just be positive? Is it good to just be negative? Is it good to sandwich, you know, negative, positive, negative, positive, negative, positive? So those are some of the things I think about: talking too much on the positive side, too much on the negative side. Try to stay away from that. You try to have some type of balance there. And I would say the other negative trap that I have down is like, just because a conversation is going to be uncomfortable doesn't give you the right to not have it. That is something that I'm currently like learning and trying to be better at. And honestly, the last week has like, there've been a lot of those conversations and I felt so much better after the fact. But you can't let the player fail or yourself fail by just running away from the difficult conversation that has to happen. It is our job to put the player in the best possible scenario on any given night. And a lot of times that means having a difficult conversation that nobody likes. Some people are crazy and like love confrontation. Like, I know it has to happen. I don't love it, but it needs to get done. So I would say avoiding negative conversations and those difficult conversations is also like a negative trap.
Right. It turns into something bigger if you just allow it to fester, then the story becomes bigger. And yeah, but yeah, it's easier to avoid than to run at it.